Next case is 06-1604, James Sinnott versus Aqua Chemical, Inc. Ms. Audi.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Susan Audi, and I am here on behalf of American Optical Corporation and Numo Abex. With me at the council table is Reginald Kramer, and he is representing Westinghouse Corporation. I will be presenting the argument on behalf of all three entities, and I ask to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time there, the clock.
We are here today asking this court to provide clear direction to the appellate courts of this state in the analysis that's required in determining when a provisional remedy is a final appealable order. As this court noted in Gem versus Timberline not too long ago, the final order analysis has attracted the attention of this court. And although I may be mistaken, I believe this is the last of 10 cases that this court has accepted for review on the final order issue, underscoring the need for a review of this case. The provisional remedy at issue in this case is a prima facie showing. A specifically referenced provisional remedy made effective by the amendment to the final order statute by House Bill 292. As this court heard yesterday in In Re Special Docket, House Bill 292 was enacted in 2004 as part of comprehensive asbestos litigation reform. Part of that act enacted specific requirements for an asbestos plaintiff to satisfy in order to avoid administrative dismissal. Those requirements are primarily medical in nature, and although the specific requirements are not at issue here or whether they have been satisfied, neither is the constitutionality of House Bill 292 at issue here. What is at issue is whether the order that the trial court put out indicating that Mr. Sinnott here had made a prima facie showing of asbestos-related injury, whether that order is a final appealable order. When the General Assembly enacted House Bill 292 in 2004, it specifically referenced a prima facie showing as a provisional remedy. However, merely being included within the definition of a provisional remedy is not sufficient. There are two additional requirements that are required in order for the order to be considered to be a final appealable order. The first requirement is that the judgment must not only determine the action with respect to the provisional remedy, but it almost also must prevent a judgment with respect to the provisional remedy. And I submit that that particular requirement is easily answered in this case. This court has made clear in State v. Muncie and State v. Upshaw the analysis that's required in determining when that first requirement is satisfied. And here we have the prima facie showing order determining the action as to the prima facie showing, and that prevents a contrary judgment in favor of appellants here that Mr. Sinnott has not made a prima facie showing. So the first requirement is easily satisfied. What is more challenging is when the analysis that's required in determining when the second requirement is satisfied, and that is whether there or when the particular judgment prevents a meaningful remedy in an appeal following final judgment on all issues. And I submit to this court that that analysis requires looking at the legislative history of House Bill 292. And the General Assembly was very explicit in that legislative history. In very detailed, uncodified law, the General Assembly set forth the reasons for enacting House Bill 292. The overriding concern being that the scarce and dwindling resources of asbestos defendants would be preserved for the protection of asbestos plaintiffs who are able to satisfy the minimum medical requirements. I submit to you that if this court were to find this is not a final appealable order at this time, to go back and have this case proceed through trial and then at the end of a verdict in favor of defendant, for sure would not be necessary for us to go ahead and appeal that. If it were to go back to trial and there would be a verdict for plaintiff, it would not make any sense for an asbestos defendant at that time to go back and say, this did not make any sense for me to go ahead and say the...
So the issue would be moot at the end of a trial because...
Maybe not necessarily moot. That may not be a good comparison. I try to think of something that would be close to it. It certainly wouldn't be error that we would be able to assign when we say that the specific intention of that statute is...
But your argument is that a prima facie case was not shown at the get-go, and therefore... Your argument is that it wasn't shown. The trial court said it was shown. Let's move on. Let's go to trial.
Correct.
Okay. And you're saying that if you then are proceeding to trial, you lose at trial. It doesn't do you any good because there's no recourse to challenge the initial ruling. However, what prejudice is there to you at that point when the entire... the plethora of evidence that has been presented far exceeds even the prima facie level in order for the jury to find for the plaintiff?
That's exactly right. What would be the purpose for us, even in an appeal following final judgment on a verdict, to go back and not only appeal the judgment on that verdict, but then to go back and say, we shouldn't have gone to trial in the first place?
But the fact of the matter is, if the plaintiff prevails at trial, isn't that in and of itself a showing that there was more than prima facie evidence, and yes, you should have been at trial?
Well, that's why I likened it that it possibly could be moot to the denial of a motion for summary judgment, although that may not be a correct or purposeful
point,
analogy.
Well, at that point, your ability to appeal wouldn't be based on the initial determination that there was a prima facie case of medical condition presented to the trial court. You'd have to have other evidence or other basis for appeal, the award of damages. Not, you wouldn't be appealing the illness or the injury or the medical evidence that was sufficient to find for the plaintiff by the jury.
That's what makes it meaningless for us to wait until final judgment on all issues to go back and try to address that issue at that time. It would make no sense for us to go ahead and argue that this should have not gone to trial in the first place. When it went to trial costs were incurred, there was a verdict in favor of the plaintiff. The bigger fish to catch would be to go after and appeal the judgment on the verdict. That's what makes the remedy as far as appealing the prima facie showing at that time following final judgment entirely meaningless.
Counsel, I'm having the same problem Justice O'Connor is. If you, as here, the trial court determined that the evidence from the Veterans Administration Hospital was sufficient to establish a prima facie case on the part of this particular claimant, that determination would mean that the trial judge, in applying the new statute, found this is a person that should be at the front of the bus. Now you go ahead and try it, and the issues as to prima facie case are subsumed by the proof that was offered and the contesting of that proof that took place at the trial.
Well, that's what would make it unnecessary or meaningless for us to appeal that the prima facie showing
was
not satisfied.
What purpose is served by appealing that?
The verdict?
The only purpose that seems to be served is delay, which is a delay
on the asbestos defendant's part in appealing that? Well, are you talking about appealing the judgment on the final verdict as well as appealing the
appealing?
Then I'm misunderstanding
an,
you.
An interlocutory appeal on this issue when
Correct.
The judge has said you met what the General Assembly wants you to do.
Mm-hmm.
It would seem that...
But if that medical evidence that's presented in this case, it was the medical records from Mr. Sinnott's stay at the Veterans Administration Hospital in West Virginia, if that medical evidence does not meet the statutory requirements, then it's showing that there is no prima facie showing. Now, the trial judge in this case said that those medical records did satisfy the intent of the statute, but we're saying that they did not meet that. We didn't get to that issue, whether he did or did not, and that's not before this court. The point is that we should be at this time be able to say, yes, there is no prima facie showing of asbestos relative impairment shown at this time. And we should be able to say that his evidence to, in support of that is incorrect. And we should be able to appeal that at this time, because if we were to not appeal it, I'm misunderstanding you.
Going to the second, and what you said is the more problematic issue is, you, as Justice Connor indicated, you get a meaningful remedy, a meaningful determination by appeal of the case after it's tried that you lost. You get a meaningful decision on whether or not there was sufficient medical proof of the claim.
Well, then that completely eviscerates the medical minimum medical requirement statute. The whole intent of House Bill 292.
Well, but your argument seems to be that the purpose of that is to facilitate further delay on the part of the defendants.
No, if I said that, I
Well, you didn't say that, but that has to be the logical conclusion.
Well, I disagree, Justice Pfeiffer, because the intent of House Bill 292 in enacting those minimum medical requirements was to preserve the funds of asbestos defendants for asbestos plaintiffs who had an asbestos-related injury.
And the judge said, looks like this one does.
Okay, and we're saying that the medical records submitted don't satisfy that statute. They, for whatever reason, which is not before this court, is that they do not satisfy that. So at this point, if we were to go forward with trial and not be able to say that, yes, he doesn't make that prima facie showing at this time, completely eviscerates the minimum medical requirement statute, because the entire purpose of that was to not incur trial-related funds and to preserve funds of the dwindling resources of asbestos defendants. And that's the entire purpose of the medical minimum medical requirements. And to say that we cannot prove that or cannot challenge it at this time completely makes that statute meaningless then.
It would seem that the General Assembly wanted amended the statutes, as you said, and obviously they did, should have also amended and prevents a judgment. I think that's the problem we're having, is that how does this decision about which you complain, the trial judge may have been dead wrong, but it doesn't seem to prevent a judgment. I mean, I agree with you that from the policy standpoint, General Assembly wanted to in effect move cases, permit the trial judges to move cases to the front of the docket, in which there was some real medical evidence and some damage to the plaintiffs. But we have to get around this language and prevents that decision prevents a judgment, which it clearly does not, does it?
But the prevent a judgment part of the provisional order, or the final provisional remedy final order analysis, goes to preventing a judgment as to the provisional remedy. It does not go to the preventing a judgment, to preventing the ultimate judgment. That is the first part of the provisional remedy order analysis.
That part of the statute wasn't amended to say that.
No, it was amended. The only part that was amended was the definition of provisional remedy itself,
and
to include that. Right, that's clear in that. What are two additional requirements that were not touched?
Well, counsel, if the judge is just drop dead wrong on this, then you're going to win in the Court of Appeals after you've lost a trial to a jury. Or a trial, and the Court of Appeals would have the ability to say, we're reversing on the medical evidence, we find it insufficient, and we even believe it's so insufficient that the judge was wrong. So they can say that on the
correct
determination as to whether or not there was sufficient prima facie evidence to go forward.
Correct. And
so you could still get the judgment that you want and the smackdown on the judge for making the wrong call here.
Are you talking about at final judgment, after final judgment as to all issues? But would that make any sense for us to go ahead and argue that at that point? Because at that point, it already proceeded to trial. Trial-related expenses have been incurred. The whole purpose of the statute was to prevent depletion of asbestos resources or asbestos defendants' resources. At that point, that whole statute then is eviscerated and made meaningless. So it doesn't really make any sense that we should say this should not go to trial now. We shouldn't have had to have spent money on trial when those funds are already spent and cannot be unspent.
Counsel, I think another fair interpretation of the way your client is employing this is to use the statute to just delay everything.
I disagree with that, Your Honor, for two reasons. In the beginning, we may see an initial increase in some of the appeals until there's some flesh put to these to this statute. Once it becomes known that what the minimum medical requirements satisfy and what evidence satisfies that, you will see a decrease in the number of appeals. And then the intent of the statute will be satisfied. So you may see some initial increase in appeals until there is some flesh put to that statute. After that, anyone who would bring further appeals based on that or well-settled law on that issue is going to be subject to frivolous conduct sanctions or Rule 11 sanctions.
Shouldn't we assume that the General Assembly, because of what it amended and what it did not amend in 02, assumed that trial judges would be fair gatekeepers of the asbestos cases, and albeit here you'd think the trial judge made a mistake. Mm-hmm. But isn't that the sense of what the General Assembly did? Is they went part way with the provisional remedy definition, but it seems to me the General Assembly also said, in effect, we're going to let the trial judges be the gatekeepers here, and there may be an error now and then, but that's our system. What's your response to that?
I don't disagree with that at all. However, in part of that gatekeeping role, they are going to be looking at what, you know, are those two requirements satisfied? And for the most part, they will be satisfied in most cases. And in probably all of the cases that come before it, those two requirements will be satisfied. But that is the purpose of enacting or making the provisional remedy class of final orders. And actually, that class of final orders was at the invitation of this court in Walters versus Enrichment to go ahead and amend that statute to provide a remedy for interlocutory appeal. I see that my time is up, and I will reserve the rest of my time.
Ms. Ranke.
Thank you, Your Honors. Chief Justice Moyer, Justices of the Supreme Court, may it please the court, my name is Kay Ranke, and I'm here arguing today on behalf of the plaintiff, the estate of Jim Sinnott. The issue before this court is whether or not a preliminary summary evidentiary standard involving prima facie evidence of a case can be immediately appealed absent a final determination on the merits. And I believe if you look at the rules of civil procedure, which have been in effect since 1970, as well as the clearly established case law on this point, although there are numerous cases that still come before this court to determine what is a final appealable order, the answer is no. This type of determination is not ripe for immediate appellate review.
Counsel, if the court were to find that you had not presented sufficient prima facie evidence and had put you into the administrative dismissal category, where you have to wait until you get sufficient evidence to renew your case, is that a final appealable order?
I would say yes, and here's the reason why. Because that is a determination of all of the case in its entirety. A dismissal, whether you call it an administrative dismissal or otherwise, is an outcome on every pending issue in the court. So once the case is dismissed, there is nothing remaining in the trial court, and that falls within every universally accepted definition of a final appealable order. That's a big distinction.
But the argument is that it doesn't really dismiss anything. It just puts you on a wait track until you have sufficient evidence, at which time you can bring it up again. So you really aren't concluded, you aren't ended, you're just waiting in line so that, as we've been using the phrase in the last 2 days, the serious cases go to the head of the bus.
Well, with all due respect, Justice, I would urge you to recognize one thing, which is it is not simply, administrative dismissal is not simply going to the back of the bus. It's getting off the bus and having your claim, in essence, the claim that exists today that has already vested on the behalf of the litigant by filing his case and getting in line, he's never able to reinstate that claim as exists today because defendants want the person to have to meet new burdens that didn't exist at the time his claim vested. So it is not simply waiting in line.
The defendants don't want that. The statute is requiring it.
Well, I believe, Your Honor, that first of all, if you take a look at what the asbestos tort reform did as a whole, it doesn't merely prioritize the case. That's what they'll argue. They'll argue that it's a prioritization. The trial court in Cuyahoga County, which has a dedicated docket and has for some time has always had a prioritization of cases, and there have always been the most severe cases to go to the front of the line. Jim Sinnott was determined to be one of those truly sick people that needed to get to the front of the line. And in fact, what happened in this case is that we put it on the trial docket. He was able to present his evidence. The trial court reviewed that summary evidence and said, you've met your burden, and what is at issue is a delay of that case. And if you follow the case, again, Jim Sinnott's case, through its logical conclusion, you'll understand that there are a number of other remedies short of a full trial and its verdict that a defendant in a case would be allowed. First of all, you would have the summary judgment standard. The summary judgment which would determine whether or not there's exposure, whether or not there's identification, all of the things that are required in a normal case. And in fact,
Counsel, I think we're all aware that once it is on the track for trial, all of that is available, all the remedies, all the motions, et cetera. What I want to bring you back to is your statement that an administrative dismissal is a prejudicial activity with relation to the plaintiffs and would be an immediately appealable order. My understanding is if a plaintiff is administratively dismissed, it is based on a showing that the medical evidence presented did not meet the standard of a prima facie case to allow it to go forward. However, there's nothing to stop then that plaintiff garnering additional medical evidence and submitting it to the court. There's no timetable that locks them into, you can't present additional medical evidence, for X amount of months or weeks or years even. Is that correct?
I would agree, Your Honor, that an administrative dismissal does not, as it's contemplated herein, does not involve a problem with the statute of limitations. However, you have to take a look again at a case such as Jim Sinnott, where the prima facie showing that the defendants actually challenged is that not that there weren't medical records submitted, not that those findings and the x-rays and all of the medical evidence did not show some causal link to asbestos exposure. Mr. Sinnott had a lung cancer. In fact, while this case has been pending, he's died. His wife
that.
Has died. But the issue is that under House Bill 292, the requirement is a written report from a treating physician, all right? And in the case of Mr. Sinnott, he was treated at the Veterans Administration Hospital as a veteran. The Veterans Administration Hospital saw different doctors all the time. So if you discount the ability of the medical records to speak for themselves and say, this is the causal link, it's related to asbestos exposure just on a prima facie basis.
We're not here to talk about the quality of the medical report. That's not, whether it's the Veterans Administration, 12 doctors from the Veterans Administration, or one treating physician in another case that has that patient start to finish. That's not what we're here for. I'm concerned that you say that the defendants have no right to appeal based on an adverse ruling on a prima facie case, yet the plaintiff does. Now that to me, piqued my interest and I want to hear more about that analysis because I don't know that you can have it both ways.
Well, this is my reason, and I'm not trying to get into it, but I'm trying to point out that in some cases, there might be a way that the prima facie problem could be cured, all right? It could be something. In the case of Mr. Sinnott, absent some written report of the doctor de jure, his case could never be cured, all right? So in some cases, an administrative dismissal on behalf of the defendants, the plaintiff may have the right to resume it. But in most cases, most of the asbestos cases, the administrative dismissal is an outcome. It's a final outcome, a decision on the merits. It's a dismissal of the case off of the docket entirely. And unless you meet new burdens that have arisen after the filing of your case and the vesting of your rights, you can never resume that injury, that claim that exists today.
Would you define those new burdens?
Sure. They're long. One of them is it changes what's considered substantial occupational exposure. It defines it and limits it to certain types of people, one of the big things, one of the problems that the plaintiff's bar has with it is it would not allow for a person who has take-home exposure, and there are known cases where a person has contracted asbestos-related disease, cancer, from simply doing the laundry of their employees. And if that person contracts the asbestos-related disease but didn't have the occupational exposure as it's defined, then they don't have the right to bring a claim. Secondly, it sets forth what's the treating physician, competent medical authority. That's a separate standard from any other personal injury case that's required in the state of Ohio. So you're trying to carve out.
So you're viewing an existing case, not administratively dismissed, as not having to meet those burdens at trial, but after an administrative dismissal, which merely removes it from the active trial docket, but not dismissal through the clerk's office, as having to meet a new burden, a new evidentiary burden.
Yes, and I would say to the court that the injury that was filed, that was recognized, that claim cannot be reactivated, and I don't believe that it's
when
just simply...
When you say reactivated, administrative dismissal doesn't prejudice, it doesn't cause a plaintiff to have to refile a new action.
If you're talking about just simply the act of filing a new case and getting a new case number, it does not involve that because it is simply a reactivating of the case for procedural purposes. However, the claim that the person was waiting in line for, the injury that he is seeking compensation for, if he does not meet the new medical burden, he can never bring that claim.
All right.
And simply by virtue of a change in the law in one date, that clearly is not accepted.
Thank you.
Counsel, could you educate us just a little bit on
maybe
the realities of the world today? Is asbestos now cleared pretty much from our environment? So is this all historical exposure, or is there new exposure occurring to people today?
Well, I think there is some exposure that's still continuing today. Most importantly, however, from the prior exposure, prior to the ban, people are still getting sick.
Well, I understand that, but that's
why it's so important.
So the world of cases that the courts are potentially looking at, that the defendants are potentially looking at, there's been some cutoff because of removal of asbestos, effective cutoff of that. So what's lying in wait are, because there's a long, how long can this be latent and not evidence itself in any medical condition?
They recognize is generally no earlier than 15 years, but it can be as long, the latency period can be in excess of 25 years.
Okay.
So there is a long period, and so I agree that there is a limited universe.
At what point, how long ago did this, but did most of the opportunity for exposure go away?
Depends on the type of exposure, but primarily late into the 80s would be the time period that asbestos was
We're soon coming up on a period of time in which most people who were exposed will be showing signs of illness.
That is correct. Soon being a term of art, I guess.
Well, in the next 5 years or so.
Right. And Justice Pfeiffer, I believe an important point. Yesterday, I was here for the NRA All special docket, and you asked counsel, Mr. Schuster, how many bites at the apple do you want? And I think that the Jim Sinnott case is important to point out in a real case environment that they want the ability to appeal on the retroactivity issue in a vacuum. Then they want the ability to delay a case and appeal it after some primary prima facie showing, and then still have all the rights to make the case return and then continue appeal. And the 40,000 cases that have been mentioned repeatedly in briefs and in argument that are pending on Cuyahoga County docket, each one of those, if you allow a prima facie decision on that preliminary matter to result and be considered a final appealable order, all of those cases are going to go up for appeal. All of those cases are going to ultimately have the right to come to the Supreme Court if there's a significant issue, and that is simply contrary to the idea of a final appealable order, which requires, absent special circumstances, a determination on the merits. And look at the cases that have been argued. Muncie. Muncie involved forced injection of psychotropic drugs, all right? That's a pretty emergency type of situation that should involve appellate review. The other case, Upshaw, is another criminal case which involved basically a decision that was, you're not competent to stand trial, so we're going to confine you in a mental institution until at some point, whenever that is, that you become competent to stand trial. There's no end to that. And absent some type of review, that person's rights would never be able to be raised. This is a summary standard, and the bill itself, 2307.93b, says the court shall resolve the issue of whether the plaintiff has made a prima facie showing required by division B, C, or D by applying the standard for resolving a motion for summary judgment. They're telling you, they're giving you some guidance. Summary judgment rulings, the person who is unfavorably affected by a summary judgment decision, can never seek immediate appellate review. It always requires a decision on the outcome. And we ask you not only to find that a prima facie showing did not result in an immediate appeal on behalf of Mr. Sinnott, but on behalf of all asbestos cases, because we don't want them to be delayed in this type of fashion. Thank you.
As I understand the earlier discussion, if a trial judge wrongly interprets the statute, if in fact the statute applies at some point, I suppose there needs to be a decision about that, but and then after trial, it's really not effective to appeal the case anymore. And there are 38,000 cases on the docket. We have an issue that's going to reoccur over and over and over, with trial judges perhaps not applying the criteria properly, and then from the defendant's standpoint, that never a practical way of appealing and getting a higher court to interpret or set a standard as to what the trial judges have to apply. So you have a reoccurring problem yet evading review. Isn't that the essence of having no effective remedy unless you have an immediate appeal?
Well, I believe no effective remedy is the essence. However, I don't believe that that meets this case, and I don't believe that the prima facie applying of a medical criteria is that type of situation. You also have, in addition to the summary judgment standard, you have Daubert. You have an ability to challenge medical evidence and the soundness of the medical criteria and the evidence produced prior to trial and all of the expenses, and have the trial court, again, who is appropriate gatekeeper, you have the right to have them say, you know, that evidence isn't sound.
But in essence,
and those are all.
But in essence, the issue that we're talking about that's involved in this case and will be involved in lots of cases never will get a review by a higher court in all practicality.
A preliminary evidentiary standard in any kind of case never gets an immediate appellate review. And I don't believe that asbestos cases are unique and should be required or should be carved out an exception to allow that. There are effective remedies through Daubert, summary judgment, motions in limine, other ways to challenge this issue of medical criteria. A trial court, as in any type of personal injury case, is an appropriate gatekeeper. And if you allow every single procedural and preliminary summary evidentiary standard to be reviewed, a final appealable order has, in effect, no meaning whatsoever. And when you're deciding this case, you're deciding on Mr. Sinnott's case, but in addition, you're saying that there is no meaning to the final appealable order because we're going to allow just asbestos cases to have this special exception. And I don't believe that that's what the law intended, the rules.
But isn't that what the statute says? When you say that's not what the law intended.
Well, if you're talking about House Bill 292, they also then say it's a summary judgment standard, which doesn't allow for immediate.
Summary judgment standard of review, it doesn't say it is equated to a summary judgment or has the same effect subsequent to a ruling on a summary judgment. That's just a standard of review.
It doesn't, I agree with you, it doesn't say. It does say that this prima facie showing should be required or should be allowed to have an immediate review, but the summary judgment standard tells you the type of decision it is. It's the type of review that the trial court is making, and a summary judgment does not allow for immediate appellate review. And if you look at the modern courts, the legislature can, if they have well-meaning intention, which as a plaintiff's attorney, I don't agree perhaps with the intent of the legislature. However, I would say to you that the legislature, despite their well-meaning intent, does not have the right to encroach or usurp upon what is within the bounds of the law. The court to establish, and a final appealable order is defined by case law and the rules of civil procedure. And this type of summary, immediate appellate review of a summary decision without a decision on the merits is clearly in conflict with what has been established prior. And I see my time is up.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ranke. Ms. Audie, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
I just wish to clarify that this is not a new medical burdens case. The trial court determined that House Bill 292 applied to this case, even though counsel argued that in the trial court. The trial court made the determination that the minimum medical requirements applied to this case. They did not appeal that decision. So this is not a new medical burdens case. We're not, if there is an administrative dismissal, there is nothing that is preventing Mr. Sinnott or his estate from bringing the necessary minimum medical requirements. Secondly, there will not be an indefinite increase in appeals. Once there is flesh to the statute, once there's contours placed on what is and what is not satisfies the prima facie showing, then you will see the appeals decrease. And lastly, the civil rules do not define a final order, and neither do the appellate rules. Nowhere in either of those rules is there a definition for a final order. The only place you will find the definition of a final order is in the final order statute 250502. And with that,
counsel, before you sit down, the last bit of discussion we had with co-counsel had to do with the summary judgment language and what that means in context here. What's your take on that?
The summary judgment standard is merely an evidentiary standard when ruling on whether Mr. Sinnott has satisfied the prima facie showing. There, when you're looking at that, you're looking at is if there is any absence of any genuine issue of material fact. Using that standard to determine whether a prima facie showing order has been satisfied is merely that, just a standard. It does not equate the ruling with a ruling on a motion for summary judgment. And if even if it did, it would make no sense if the General Assembly was the one who put that standard in there, and it also put in there to say, yes, a prima facie showing will be immediately reviewable as well. So that does not make any sense with that. And I will take one last issue with something that counsel brought up. I'm sorry.
Very quickly.
Okay. The administrative dismissal is not getting off the bus. As I said, they will have the opportunity to present that information. Thank you,
Your Honor. Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.